how does hostility to Christianity make you feel? You know, you have a conversation with someone, one of your friends, and they clearly hate the fact that you're a Christian. How do you respond? Yeah, I can remember a friend of mine about a year ago on Facebook. He shared an article that said in Iceland there were no Christians left under 30. And he was celebrating this. He was looking forward to the day when that was true of the UK, when Christianity just petered out and died out and there was no one left. Maybe you know someone like that. Maybe there's not hostility that's the issue, but you know that feeling of that sinking feeling of someone who used to be a Christian, they're not a Christian anymore. And you just know the sadness of feeling like, what's going on? Why is the church shrinking? Why is this friend no longer interested in Jesus? I remember I felt that loads of times about some friends, but I remember feeling, oh yeah, Jonathan Edwards, the Olympic triple jump gold medalist who used to present songs of praise, and now he's not a Christian. At those times, it's tempting to lose confidence in Jesus. I think it is. I don't consciously think, well, Jesus isn't powerful, but I just don't think about him at all. I just accept that people are right. Sure, they're right. Christianity is going to die out. That's what I think. I believe that. And I believe that, as they say, I'm on the wrong side of history. I lose confidence in Jesus. Maybe in those situations, it's tempting to change what we do. As a church, we spend time focused on the Bible. Well, we do at Bushell Park, and you do here as well. The sermon takes up a big chunk of the service. We've already had a talk from the Bible for the kids. And then there's sort of stuff like women's Bible study and midweek small group going on. And, you know, Causeway spends a lot of time focused on the Bible. Maybe, you know, there are big successful churches out there. Maybe Causeway or Bushell Park needs to look at what they're doing. And maybe they've got a silver bullet. Maybe we need to get on board with projects in the community or try and pour resources into sort of amazing music and that kind of thing. Maybe we need to focus our energy on something else other than teaching the Bible. Or maybe it's tempting not to change that, but to, you know, slightly change what we're teaching. So we do want to keep preaching and teaching, but maybe teaching all of the Bible is just a bit too far. Let's keep the sermon, but let's make sure the message connects with this generation. And so if there are things that we don't think they'd like, well, let's steer away from it. You know, the Bible was written 2,000 years ago. Maybe it was right for them and it was good for them, but society's changed, and so we need to preach something that will connect with them. I wonder if Jesus I don't think Jesus would, but I wonder if his disciples would have felt something similar in verse 7 as he withdrew to the lake. You've been going through Mark, so you'll know that Jesus has been having a series of sort of face-offs with the Pharisees. And they've not gone well. And maybe you've seen they've gone progressively sort of more and more hostile. So to begin with, in chapter 2, with sort of where Jesus heals the paralyzed man, their objection is, oh, you're a human. You can't forgive that guy's sins. And, you know, maybe we want to give them the benefit of the doubt at this point and say, you know, they're right. God forgives sins. You know, maybe it's just they've misunderstood Jesus and, you know, let's cut them a bit of slack. But then he calls Levi, the tax collector. And we learn that Jesus has come to be a doctor for sinners. And the Pharisees, well, they keep away from sinners. They don't like sinners. And then in the next sort of confrontation, we find that Jesus has come bringing something new. And, well, the Pharisees, they just want to keep hold of their old way of doing things, and they're not interested in the new. And then we learn that Jesus wants to give life and rest to people. And the Pharisees, well, again, they're more interested in their rule keeping. And when they see Jesus giving life in a way that breaks their rules, well, actually, they plot to kill him. And so what could have been a misunderstanding has descended into outright hostility. And, you know, a lot of us will be used to the Pharisees as being the pantomime villains of the Gospels. And, you know, we're used to them popping their heads out and being the typical bad guys. But, you know, these were the people who loved their Bibles. These were the people who cared about obeying God. Or in their minds they thought they did. And so this would have been a shock. You could imagine that for Jesus' disciples, this would have felt like a setback. And so if you're here this morning intimidated by a hostile friend, or feeling like your efforts in making Jesus known aren't getting anywhere, well, it's great, because this morning we can see how Jesus responds to that sort of situation. And if you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you need to see how Jesus responds to people rejecting him. Now, I'm not saying that you plan to kill him like the Pharisees. But if you don't like Christianity, if you're not interested in what Jesus has to teach, and you're happy for it to just peter out and die out, then what Jesus does this morning has something to say to you. So, what does Jesus do in response to this opposition? What does Jesus do? Well, firstly, in verses 7 to 12, he just carries on with his ministry. Jesus continues with his ministry. So in verse 7, where we read he withdrew with his disciples to the lake, he's not running away scared. If anything, he's just getting away from the Pharisees so he can carry on with what he's been doing uninterrupted. Is Jesus bothered by the opposition? No. He's still popular. If anything, his popularity is increasing. So people are coming over from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, the regions across the Jordan, Tyre and Sidon. If you get to look at a map, some of the Bibles may have maps, some of them don't. But Idumea, that's about 100 miles south. Tyre and Sidon is about sort of 40 miles north. And people are coming sort of from everywhere in between. And they're coming on foot. Now, it was the Six Nations yesterday, so England played Italy in Twickenham, and I imagine there were some Italian fans who flew over from Rome or wherever in Italy to watch. They've wanted to watch Italy lose rugby so much that they've flown hundreds of miles. They really wanted to watch the rugby at Twickenham. There are people here in Mark 3 who have walked 50 miles, 100 miles, to come and see Jesus. No planes, no trains. They've walked. They've not been able to just, like, do it as a long weekend. This would have been, I don't know, weeks? These are people who really wanted to come and see Jesus. And the crowd is so big, people are so desperate to touch Jesus that they're crowding around him and they're stopping him from being able to preach. So he asked the disciples to get a boat. Now, It doesn't say here that the boat is to allow him to preach, but in chapter 4, verse 1, the crowd gathered so large that he got into a boat and sat in it on the lake. So, you know, everyone's out on the shore and Jesus is sitting in his boat teaching them. And the same thing's going on here. It's so chaotic. People are so desperate to touch Jesus and to be healed that he needs to get in a boat to be able to preach to them. He's also casting out evil spirits. The evil spirits were the spiritual beings opposed to God. I guess, you know, you've been going through Mark, so you'll have come across evil spirits before. Mark assumes that there's a spiritual realm. You know, after all, he assumes there's God. And that spiritual realm is divided, and some spirits are hostile to God. And Jesus has authority over them. And just as he's done before, he commands them and they obey. They know he's the Son of God. They fall down before him. And Jesus tells them to leave people and they leave. Jesus has, he keeps his ministry of authority over evil. He keeps doing it. We might be slightly confused why Jesus tells them not to say who he is and why to keep quiet about why he's the Son of God. In short, he doesn't want people to get the wrong end of the stick. So later on, Peter finds out that Jesus is the Christ and he doesn't like the fact that Jesus is going to the cross. And Jesus is just trying to sort of stop that confusion of mistaken identity, or right identity but mistaken job. And so he's saying, let's keep that quiet now. So, is Jesus troubled by the opposition from the Pharisees? Well, no. He keeps doing what he's been doing. He goes around preaching, he heals people who need healing, and he casts out demons. And the crowd around him is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But actually, Jesus goes even further. He doesn't just keep doing what he's been doing. Jesus builds a ministry team. Jesus builds a ministry team in verses 13 to 19. So as he's going around this ministry, going around Galilee and people are following him, he, at some point he stops. And by this mountainside, and there's the feel of a sort of picking teams in PE, isn't there? As Jesus sort of stands out front and sort of calls Simon, come up, and James, is it? And your brother John, come here, and Andrew and Philip, and he goes through and he calls them up, and they come to him. And what have they come to do? Well, they're not on his sports team, they're on his ministry team. Now, the 12 are meant to be with Jesus so that they might he might send them out to preach and have authority to drive out demons as well. Now, is Jesus bothered by the opposition? Well, no. He keeps doing what he's been doing. And in fact, he seeks to expand, to multiply the ministry and to get a team around him to do more. He's seeking to grow the work. It's significant as well that he picks 12. The Old Testament, there were 12 tribes in Israel. Each of the 12 tribes coming from one of Jacob's sons. You know, the 12 brothers had the heads of the 12 tribes. Well, Jesus he's picking 12 apostles. It's as if he's sort of saying to the Pharisees and to the Jewish establishment that's rejected him, okay, I'm not fussed by you. I'm going to set up my own community. And there are new heads of that community. In response to the Pharisees rejecting him, it's as if Jesus is rejecting them. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm going to grow the work. And I'm going to set up a new community. Jesus doesn't care about them, really. He's not bothered. He's not fazed. He just carries on. And I think there are three implications for us. Three things for us to do when we're intimidated by the fact that someone is being hostile about Jesus. Three things we need to do. First, remember that Jesus is king. Remember that Jesus is king. It's easy to get discouraged and to lose confidence in Jesus. It's easy to believe what people say, that we're on the wrong side of history. But when the Pharisees reject him and plan to kill him, Jesus just keeps doing what he's been doing. He carries on. They may oppose him, but larger and larger crowds are coming to see him. Evil spirits are confessing that he's the Son of God. He has authority to create this new people. Jesus is king. So in that moment, when someone says, "Not Christian, you don't believe that," Jesus is king. He's not troubled by people laughing at you. He's not fazed. He's not worried about everything spiraling out of control. He's still in control. He's not suffering a crisis of confidence. You can read God's reaction to human opposition in Psalm 2. When nations band together, when people say, "Do you know what, we've had enough of God," God laughs at them. There's the image of, the stereotype of a parent holding a child at arm's length, and the child is like flailing away, fighting, and the parent's just holding their head like this. And when people oppose God, that's what it's like for God. We may feel like we're out of control, like we're in the minority and we're weak. But that's what it's like for God. And so if you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you need to know that this is who Jesus is. He is the king. He's not flustered by people rejecting him. And he doesn't pander to people. That's not to say you can't ask questions and raise objections. We want churches everywhere to be places where anyone can ask their questions, whether they've been coming to church all their life or whether they've walked into church for the first time. Of course, we want to be able to ask questions. But Jesus is king, and so we ask our questions with humility. And if we don't like what he teaches, we need to think, well, I've either misunderstood him or I'm wrong. Now, if we don't like that, well, Jesus will move on. He's the Son of God. He is God's King. If people reject them, well, he'll reject them and move on. Now, of course, Jesus loves people and he wants to reach people and save people. He came to die for people. I'm not saying that Jesus is callous or unloving. But if people are not interested in him, he's still the king. He's not going to try and pander to them like that. So that's the first point. Remember, Jesus is king. Secondly, keep preaching. Keep preaching. It's easy to look at the church, whether it's you guys looking around here or me at Bushill Park or just looking at the church in the UK and to think, where's the growth? Why are we so small? Maybe you're tempted to ask, should church be doing something different? Should we try and get some more vibrant worship? Do we need to try and get more families in? Do we need to be more active in the community and so people think we're relevant? Well, we need to keep preaching. Passages like what we've read here are helpful because they show us Jesus' priority in his ministry. Of course, people came to him for healing and he healed them. You know, when and he was willing to do that. But when they were crowding around him so much that he couldn't preach, he got into the boat so that he could. You could imagine someone saying to Jesus, "Hey, like, why are you doing this? People have come for the healing. People haven't walked 100 miles for you to preach to them. They've come because, you know, they've got a limp arm that doesn't work. That's what they've come to you for." But Jesus wants to preach. He doesn't begrudge healing, but he wants to preach. I guess a bit like how, maybe this is trivial, but trying to feed a six-year-old. And you sit down for the main course and they sort of, you know, push the things around and you can just about get them to eat the chicken and maybe some of the rice. But, you know, it's a slog to get them to sort of eat a couple of bits of broccoli. And then when the ice cream comes out, they gobble it down. And, you know, the parent doesn't begrudge giving the children ice cream. You're happy to give the children the nice food that they like. But you really want them to have the meat and the vegetables and that kind of thing. That's what you want them to eat. It's kind of like that. Jesus is happy to heal people. And when he establishes his kingdom fully and finally, he'll delight in fully eradicating suffering and pain and sickness and evil. But the thing he cares most about is preaching good news, because that's what saves people. That's what he commissioned the 12 to do. Now, you can read forward in Acts where, you know, Jesus has died and gone up to heaven. And the apostles, what do? They teach. The Christians gather round the apostles' teaching. And guess what the apostle Paul told his protege Timothy to do? He told him to preach the word. Now, of course, Jesus also commissions the disciples here to drive out evil spirits. And you can see other places in the Gospels where he gives them power to heal. But generally, the pattern in Mark is Jesus goes out to preach, and where people need healing, he heals them, and where there are evil spirits that need to be cast out, he casts them out. But he goes out to preach because he's got a message of good news that can save people. And so in the same way, churches, in the face of opposition, in the face of sort of looking around and seeing not the growth you want, churches should still prioritise preaching and holding out the word, because that's what saves. There might be all sorts of things that people would be more interested in, but it's the message that saves them, so keep preaching. But don't just keep preaching. Keep preaching the apostles' teaching. Keep preaching the apostles' teaching. I said earlier, sometimes people say something like, "Oh, you know, the Bible, all of it, 2,000 years old. Really? That's right for them, but society's moved on." But the problem with that is that the Bible is what Jesus taught. Like, he didn't write any of it, but he quotes from the Old Testament all the time. So he clearly likes that bit. And as we see here, he commissions the apostles. The New Testament was written by the apostles and by the people close to the apostles. The New Testament is the sort of the apostolic teaching. And here we see that Jesus is giving the apostles authority to teach. And so if we want to know what Jesus taught, well, we look at the New Testament. And that's what's got Jesus' stamp of authority on it. And so we keep teaching that, because that's the message that Jesus preached, which gives life. It might be tempting to change it or to go soft on some of the things that our culture doesn't like. But when we change the gospel, it's like adding salt into water. If you add salt to water, the water no longer quenches your thirst, it makes you more thirsty. If you change the gospel, it stops being a message that can save. Now, of course, if someone's not drinking the water, you think of inventive ways to persuade them to drink water. You work hard at getting them to drink water. But one thing you're never going to do is add salt to the water. Because even if that works, even if they think, yeah, I'll drink that, well, it's not going to solve the problem of them needing water. They'll get even more dehydrated. So you're not going to think about doing that. And it's the same with the gospel that Jesus preached. Yeah, we want to think about inventive ways to help people listen to it and understand it and connect with it. But we're not going to change it. We're not going to change the message because then it stops being a message that can save. And so if you're thinking about Christianity and there are some bits of it that you like and some bits that you don't like, you need to bear this in mind. That the message we find in the Bible is the message that came with Jesus' authority. And sure, there are some parts where Christians agree and some parts where Christians disagree. But if there's something that you think, that's in there and I don't like it, well, that's part of Jesus' teaching. If we change it, then it loses its power. So we need to keep preaching the apostles' teaching. If you read Acts chapter 9, you'll see how the apostle Paul became a Christian. He was called Saul at the time, and Jesus appeared to him as he was walking to Damascus. Saul at the time was leading the persecution against Christians. He was the one given power by the Jewish authorities to imprison Christians and lock them up for being Christian. And he'd overseen the first martyrdom, watching on approvingly as Stephen got stoned in Acts chapter 7. But what does Jesus say when he appears to Saul on the road? Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Saul was attacking and hunting Christians, but in Jesus' eyes, if you attack and hunt them, then you attack and hunt me. So when you're discouraged and intimidated by people who seem to hate the fact that you're a Christian, remember, that means they hate Jesus. When you read in the paper about how Christians in the UK are fools, remember, the paper is calling Jesus a fool. And how does Jesus respond to that? Well, he's not fazed. He's the Son of God. He sits enthroned on high. Here, in that situation, he kept preaching. He kept doing what he was doing. He commissioned the apostles to keep doing it too. And so let's remember that Jesus is King. Let's keep preaching, and let's keep preaching what the apostles taught.